You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. I'm your bluesologist, and we came out of the music of Bunny Wailer. He did a song called Rasta Man, The Death of Patrice Lumumba. And Patrice Lumumba, Maurice Impolo, and Joseph Okito were murdered on January 17th, 1961. And 8 years later, on January 17th, 1969, Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, and John Huggins were killed in Los Angeles, California. And we are commemorating the deaths of those five comrades. And on today's show, we have interviews with Rupert Lewis, Nikki Clark, and Noel Hanrahan, Prison Radio's Noel Hanrahan, Rupert Lewis, Jamaican-based Rupert Lewis, who is the author of books on Marcus Garvey and Walter Rodney, and Nikki Clark, who is the head of the Ontario Black History Society, and she has her own TV show. But I would like to start this show like I start every show and thank two people, Omali Ishitella, Chairman Omali Ishitella, for giving me the space to do diasporic music on Uhuru Radio, and Archie Shep, who gave me the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West but not of the West. And for whatever it is worth, Archie Shep and Chairman Omali Ishitella both come out of Florida. We wanted to begin our show, and we want to start by playing a song that was a hit in 1960. We have an article coming out in Burning Spear on Dr. Nico, and Dr. Nico is on this particular song called Independence Cha-Cha, and it's in the film Lumumba, the Raoul film Lumumba. And let's listen to a great song from Dr. Nico and others called Independence Cha-Cha.
Independence Cha-Cha, Tozumiye, Oki Kwanza, Cha-Cha, Tubakidi, O Table Ronde, Cha-Cha, Baganyeo, Oni Pada, Cha-Cha, Tozumiye, Independence Cha-Cha, Tozumiye, Oki Kwanza, Cha-Cha, Baganyeo, Oni Pada, Cha-Cha, Tozumiye.
I've played with feet before.
You know you're the biggest.
Yeah. I love feet.
You know I like you.
No.
Saw
the toes,
I'm not gonna
do it. No, I'm love to do that for you.
Man, yeah,
it's
sexy. Yeah,
it
really, I think about you. Like,
you used to call me on my. You used to. Yeah. You used to call me on my cell phone. Night when you need my love, call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love, and I know when that hotline blink, that can only mean one thing. I know when that hotline blink, that can only mean one thing. Ever since I left the city, you got a reputation for yourself now. Everybody knows and I feel left out. Girl, you got me down, you got me stressed out. Cause ever since I left the city, you started wearing less and going out more. Glasses of champagne out on the dance floor, hanging with some girls I never seen before. You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love, call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love, I know when that hotline blink, that can only mean one thing. I know when that hotline blink, that can only mean one thing. Ever since I left the city, you and me, we just don't get along. You make me feel like I did you wrong. Going places where you don't belong. Ever since I left the city, you got exactly what you asked for. Running out of pages in your passport. Hanging with some girls I've never seen before. You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love, call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love, and I know when that hotline blink, that can only mean one thing. I know when that hotline blink, that can only mean one thing. These days, all I do is wonder if you're bending over backwards for someone else. Wonder if you're rolling up a backwards for someone else. Doing things I taught you, getting nasty for someone else. You don't need no one else, you don't need nobody else, no. Why you never alone? Why you always touching roll? Used to always stay at home, be a good girl, you was in the zone. Yeah. You should just be yourself. Right now you're someone else. You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. And I know when that hotline blink, that can only mean one thing. I know when that hotline blink, can only mean one thing. Ever since I left the city,
Drake, Toronto's own Drake, and Hotline Bling is a song that I like, but I can't believe that Bob Dylan got on the TV show and actually sang that song. But Drake is a controversial figure, and we're gonna have to do an analysis of Drake, because Drake is the nephew of Larry Graham. And he is a very talented young man, but he has some very strange political alliances, and we should talk about that one day. But we heard Hotline Bling by Drake and Hotline Bling by Erykah Badu. And this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. Now we want to introduce a young man who was born in Canton, Ohio, just like LeBron James and James Ingram, but he was brought up in Birmingham, Alabama, and I think he may be in Atlanta, Georgia now, because I think he was living in New Orleans when they had the big disaster down there. But this is a young man by the name of Sir Charles Jones, and I just can't let go.
I remember one Sunday evening, I was sitting at home, and my best friend came over, and he looked at me with tears in his eyes. I ain't even have to ask him what's wrong. He looked at me, he said, I didn't go to work today. He said, I followed my woman to the traveling hotel. And it broke my heart, oh. And I said, man, maybe you just ought to forget about it. And he said, Sir Charles, maybe you never been in love, or maybe you never felt the things that I feel for a little girl. But all I know, and I sat there watching the tears roll down his face. And he looked me in my eyes and he said these words, I just can't let go. No, 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 just can't let go. No, no, no. And then he said, I never miss one day work. Never deny her the least little thing. I'm a father to the children. Sometimes I cook the food, bring home my money, let her do what she wanna do. He said, I know that I'm a good man. Why do she do the thing that she do? Why don't she understand? Still, I can't let go. No, no, no. Just can't let go. No, no, no. He said, I love the pretty little girl. I can't let go. No, no, no. Just can't let go. No, no, no. And then he said, I know everybody think it ain't cool, but everybody down the line somewhere been a fool. And then I stepped in and I said, man, you got a woman with a heart that's cold just like ice. But everyone will be a fool once, but never be a fool twice. But he said, just can't let go. Just can't let go. No, no, no. Just can't let go. No, 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 no. Just can't let go.
Hey, Aisha, hold on. I'll walk with you. You know, this is going to be a great class.
I know. Yet I'm still trying to figure out how I can exactly use these skills.
The Uhuru Movement.
The Uhuru Movement?
Yes, the Uhuru Movement. They offer great opportunities to utilize these type of skills in the most meaningful ways. I mean, writers, photography, graphic design, journalism, videography, video editing, even radio broadcasting.
Wow, sounds great. I'm assuming you have to be pretty advanced.
Not at all. I mean, although experienced is welcome, it's not mandatory. You know, the Uhuru Movement, they will train you. Log on and sign up today at uhurunews.com, where your skills are wanted and needed. Whether reporting on local news, writing for an international newspaper, or hosting your own radio show, the Uhuru Movement is the place for you. Do you have a desire to work in sales, marketing, or administration? Do you have the talent for audio engineering? Log on and sign up today, uhurunews.com. Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
Thank you, brother. I will definitely follow up today.
And hopefully you'll become a member like I am.
Uhuru, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and Melinda Francis Molly. And we are joined on the line from Montego Bay, Jamaica, by Nikki Clark, who is the president of the Ontario Black History Society and the host of the Nikki Clark Show. And she is currently speaking to us from Montego Bay, Jamaica. And Nikki, like I was telling you, the last time I was in Montego Bay, I bumped into one of my cousins from, she's from Saginaw, Michigan. Yeah. Okay. And it's a beautiful spot. I guess the first question I wanted to ask you is, the Ontario Black History Society is having their annual event to kick off Black History Month. And could you, at luncheon, I think on the 31st, could you talk about that event?
Sure. Well, first of all, I just want to give thanks to you for giving me this opportunity to share all the great things that are happening. So thank you very much for giving me the time. And yeah, we're really excited about the Black History Month kickoff fundraiser brunch, which is at the Metro Convention Center in Toronto on Front Street in the North Building. And it's from 1 p.m. to 5. And what we do is we celebrate all the great achievements in Ontario Black history and beyond, in the diaspora. And we have fantastic people there who are going to be sharing some inspirational information. And we have keynote speaker Gina Gustine, who will be there. And she's also receiving an award for all the wonderful things that she's done. She was instrumental in helping to provide all of us with Black History Month in February. So we're actually celebrating 20 years of Black History Month. So it's a very exciting time.
Gina Augustine is from Grenada, and she does a lot of work. I know she is a big supporter of Cuba, actually, and she's a diasporic woman. But she came to Canada as a housekeeper and worked her way up to becoming a minister in government.
Absolutely, and she was formerly a school teacher like myself. So she has paved the way for so many people, and I really enjoy listening to her. She's a very down-to-earth, warm-hearted woman and very much into empowering the community. So we're very fortunate to have her there, and we also have a number of other speakers and fantastic entertainment. So I'm so looking forward to it, and the tickets are available online. You can go to www.theontarioblackhistorysociety.ca. and find out more information and make your purchases online. They're $100 for a three-course meal and all the wonderful networking and entertainment that day.
Okay, could you briefly talk about some of the entertainment that's going to be there?
The entertainment, we are still confirming some names, but I'll let you know. We have a steel band playing, steel pan performer who's going to be kind of, you know, wooing people into the entrance area and entertaining them as they come in. And then we have some emerging artists We have a lot of, we have two youth members who are going to be performing the Black National Anthem and also the Canadian National Anthem, and just a couple of others. So the names are going to be released this week, but I can guarantee we've been listening to them, and we're just so pleased with just the amount of talent in Toronto and beyond is unbelievable. So we're trying to just capture all these people and put them in a tight schedule. We're trying to put in all this talent so that everyone can just benefit from this.
All right. You're listening to Diasporic Music, and I'll let Melinda ask you the next question.
Maybe talk a little bit of, you know, people who don't really know what the Ontario Black History Society does. Maybe talk a little bit about the organization itself.
Sure. The whole premise of the Ontario Black History Society, or otherwise known as, you know, the OBHS, what we do is we're there to provide a voice and also resources for people in the Black community. And our mandate is to do outreach, to get feedback from the community about what their needs are, and then working closely with the provincial and federal level of government, we're trying to get grants so that we can provide programming for the youth and for other areas in the Black community that is needing to meet gaps and to provide more information for, you know, education, history, that kind of thing. It's all about preserving Black culture, and we're doing our best to do that. But hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
Hello?
Okay. Sorry, I heard a little bit of a drop, but all of this is done through grants. The fundraiser is one of our biggest initiatives so that we can provide, we can get the money to provide all these, programming in the community. And we're looking for, sponsors, all kinds of donations, volunteers. The OBHS, I have to let you know, is volunteer driven. I'm a volunteer, and the board members are all volunteers, and we just have this mission to do what is best for the Black community and to inspire other people to get involved. There's so many people who are gifted, and they get the opportunity and they don't give back, but we're trying to appeal to those people who have the resources, have the talent, and they have the monetary means to help out the people who may not have that at the moment. So if I didn't have a mentor, I wouldn't be where I am. And I know that there are many youth who are looking for strong people, strong mentors, strong leaders who can fashion to them what it is to be a strong Black woman, strong Black man in this world. So that's what we're trying to do. And the my vision is to, like I said, I'm very focused in working with the youth and trying to create engaging programs for them because of my background as an educator. And I also want to do more in bridging the gaps between the other languages spoken by Blacks, specifically French and Spanish. So I have been reaching out, as well as the other board members, trying to reach out and to incorporate them more into what we're doing. And I'm so passionate about that because I have been given, the opportunities to learn these languages. I grew up in Montreal, so I speak French, and I also learned Spanish in university and taught Spanish actually in Jamaica. So these are the three languages that I have, and I think it's really important that in order to close all these gaps, we have to be able to communicate effectively, and I want to be able to show people that they can do the same.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and I think that's very important. Now, we used to have these discussions years ago about Spanish, well, French and Spanish, but the Western Hemisphere is Spanish speaking, and we used to advocate that the African people should speak Spanish so we can communicate with people in Chile and in Santo Domingo and so on and so forth. But the next question mm-hmm. I have for you is there were two women in Toronto. One was called uh, one woman, African Canadian by the name of Jean Daniels. She was mm-hmm. born in Nova Scotia, and she was grew up in Montreal. And there was another Jewish woman by the name of Jackie Schaffenberg. And mm-hmm. they did a lot of work around Black History Month in the 40s, 50s. And I really think that we as a community should honor them, especially Jean Daniels. She has been overlooked. And one of the reasons she's been overlooked because politically she was on the left, very
right.
much on the left. Yeah. So
okay.
I just wanted to shoot that out to the listeners.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they are, you know, formidable women. They've contributed so much. And there's so many, Norman, who are doing fantastic things. And I'm just so happy that we have what we have right now, so we can just put it all together and let all these unsung heroes in the community have a voice. So that's really the premise, like I said, of the OBHS, is to everyone has that that opportunity to share. And my part of what I'm trying to do is to fashion transparency as a way of communicating. So everything that comes to me, I make it open, I make it known to the board members, and then it trickles down to the community. And I think that's the proper way to make things move in the positive way, you know. I forgot. You mentioned the entertainers. We have the emerging artists, I mentioned that, but the featured banner, the Blackburns. And the Blackburns have their connection from the Underground Railroad. They have descendants
yes.
out of Owen Sound. So they are fantastic. And they're regularly featured at Joe Mama's on King Street. So we're really happy to have them. They're going to be playing throughout the brunch. And really happy to get them. So they are definitely confirmed. And we can share that now.
The Blackburns, their father, they had the... with a cab company, they're legendary in terms of Ontario Black history, right?
They are. They've been the Blackburns. They've been around for a number of years. The roots with, like I said, Owen Sound in Nova Scotia. So really, really, really excited to have them. And you, if you haven't heard them, you got to Google them or go on YouTube. They are fantastic. Where it's like real grassroots folk and R&B. Blues, amazing fusion.
Okay, I guess the next question, we want to talk about the Nikki Clark show.
Yeah, really excited about that. We just did a taping of the Nikki Clark show on the 14th, which is a few days ago, in Montego Bay at Millbrooks Resort. Fantastic taping. The setup was just gorgeous. Overlooking the Caribbean Sea, and we had some really powerful people on the show, and just really happy to see how things are moving in a really wonderful light. So, yeah, the show started out of, it was just kind of a whimsical thing for me. I was teaching at Sheridan College in the Faculty of Early Childhood Education, and I would say probably, I did this for 10 years. The ninth year, I started to feel like I was losing my mojo. And I was, as much as I loved teaching, I was thinking, you know what, I don't think this is going to be for the rest of my life. I think this is a good start, but I think there's something else out there. And just one day, I had an opportunity to be interviewed on a local it was an online TV station. They invited me to come down because they heard about some of the things that I was doing in the community. And I did this interview, and the station owner turned to me,
yes.
and
yes.
He said, yes. You know what, have you ever thought about having your own show? And I said, no, I never thought about it. And
yes, right.
and then
yes,
he just kind of planted a seed. And I approached him maybe about 2 months later, and I said, you know what, I'm ready to go. I think I have an idea for a show. And pitched it to him, and he said, okay, well, let's make it happen. And then the rest is his history. The show started off as something I called And the Beat Goes On, which was to give homage to the many, many talented performing artists in Toronto, to give them a showcase for their talents and then interview them. And then about three or four years later, it transformed into the Nikki Clark Show, which got a little deeper in content. Instead of just talking about musicians, I wanted to really open up the line of communication to anyone in the community. So people from all walks of life were invited to come on the show and to share not only their accomplishments, but to dig a little deeper, scratch the surface, and talk about their hard stories, and to really inspire people with some of the, you know, the hardships, the challenges, the hurdles that we all have to go through in order to get to our place of sun. And this is where it began, and this is where it's going. And it seems to be meeting a community need where people really, really want to hear these stories, so that it can get them from their place of maybe feeling isolated and not being heard, or they're not able to find the resources they need to get help. So these people come on the show and they share this information on wealth, health, beauty, spirituality, you name it. We pretty much covered everything in the last 7 years. And it's really helping people to be inspired to get unstuck in whatever place they are in their life, and to transform. So that's why the show's tagline is Transforming Lives One Story at a Time, because that's pretty much what is happening. And I'm really fortunate to have all these people in my life. The guests, some have turned into lifelong friends. And I'm really fortunate to, have had opportunity. But the biggest thing for me is the learning. I like to sit back and to facilitate the program so that I can learn. I'm the one who's being transformed from the stories as well. So it's just a wonderful thing. And I'm really blessed to, take this leap of faith. It's not easy when you decide to leave a corporate gig. I left a pretty good paying job to go out on my own and to start the show. But if you never start, you'll never know, right? And I just stuck with it, and it's moving along great. But you have to have that faith.
Let me let Melinda ask you the next question.
Well, how can people watch the show? How people can?
I'm really excited. I just got an opportunity to have the show distributed through HD Wind Caribbean, which is a specialty channel from the umbrella of Rogers TV and Bell 5. And the shows will be up in the next 2 weeks. We're just putting the content ready for that. But immediately, anyone can watch any of the episodes that have been done over the last 7 years on my online TV network, which is the NikkiClarkNetwork.com. And you'll see the fantastic, the phenomenal guests that have come through over the last few years.
Could we talk to Richard Wright? We have a few more minutes left.
You're with a
young man by the name of Richard Wright?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to introduce you to Richard Wright, who is the owner of Millbrook's Resort and also the Millbrook Campground, where we're heading to right now in Tangle River, Thinking.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, how are you? How are you doing?
Not bad.
So we wanted to give you a few moments to talk about what you wanted to talk about, my friend.
Okay. Well, I just want to let you know that, I'm the general manager and owner of Millbrook Resort and Camp Millbrook in Montego Bay, Jamaica. What we do, it's quite different than most other hotels, in that we look to promote heritage. We look to promote education, and we just look to promote any kind of collaboration as far as bringing groups to Jamaica to collaborate with like-minded people here so it can create a greater sense of family and a greater sense of business atmosphere. Millbrook Resort is a five-star villa situated in a the gated community in the Rose Hall, Montego Bay area. You can find us online if you Google Millbrooks Resort, MontegoBay.com. We have a USA, Canada a number you can reach us. But aside from providing hospitality services, we're very conscious of the need for people in diaspora to be connected and to be empowered. So we're doing a number of things. If you go on our website and you look in the things to do at Millbrook section, you can see a lot of the, you know, a lot of the programs that we are involved with. I'll tell you, the campsite is situated in probably one of the most historic parts of the island. You may not know, but Jamaica was used as a hub for the human trafficking through Africa back in the 16th century, 17th century. Between 1700 and 1786, over 600,000 slaves were brought to Jamaica, and every year over 160,000 slaves were taken to North America, resold to other plantations in North America and the Caribbean. Knowing that, we have the Millbrook Resort has embarked on a thing that we call heritage tourism, where we'd like to set up a science history museum, where we'll do genealogy, and people of African descent that have come to the resort. Now, the campsite is situated in the area. Like I said, it's probably the most historic part of Jamaica, where the emancipation fight took place between the English and the Maroons. This fight led up to the sign of the peace treaty, where the Maroons are issued a certain section of land in that area that is now considered sovereign and is under Maroon law. There's a lot of artifacts that we have here. There's a great sense of history, and we want to share that with the people of diaspora whose ancestry may have come through Jamaica back in the 1700s.
Richard, I'm sorry, but yeah. We only have a few minutes left. Can we bring you on at another time for a show to just talk about this, talk about what you're doing?
Okay, definitely. We'd love to do that.
Could we need to talk back to Nikki Clark, but thank you very much, and that sounds very fascinating as what you're doing, and we'll get back to you, please. We will definitely get back to you.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm more than willing to speak to you at any time.
Anybody named Richard Wright has to be a good man.
Hi, Norman.
Yes.
Yeah, that was Richard Wright, so... I just wanted to thank you again for giving us this chance to share all the great stuff that's happening. And I want to thank you for being a facilitator for so many people who want to share this story. So keep up the great work.
Well, I just want you to sum up by saying, just talk about what's going to take place on the 31st one more time.
Yes, the Ontario Black History Society fundraiser brunch at the Metro Convention Center, January 31st, a Sunday afternoon, 5 p.m., group entertainment. Keynote speaker is Jean Augustine. The featured band are the Blackburns, and you can get your tickets. They're $100, three-course meal, all the wonderful things attached to it, online at the Ontario Black History Society.com. Sorry, .ca.
.ca.
.ca, yeah. Ontario Black History Society, .ca. If you'd like to send a message to me, if you'd like to share information or get resources, or if you have some feedback about the Black community, please email me directly at presidentontarioblackhistorysociety.ca.
And this is the 20th anniversary of, I didn't understand, were you sent this the 20th anniversary of the event, or what is the 20th anniversary? What is the
20th anniversary of Black History, of the Black History Society, since we've been around the 20th anniversary.
Oh, okay. I guess you forgot to mention it was started by Dr. Dan Hill, correct?
Dr. Dan Hill. the Wilson, the Mr. Wilson, who is another founding member, and also Beverly Salmon was in the conversation about putting this together. They actually, they had, how it happened was organically, was at a dinner meeting, at sort of a dinner meeting at Dr. Hill's home, and they said, let's see what we can do, and then from there is where we are now, and we've taken up the trophy to make this a wonderful event for everyone, and to continue with the mandate that they started to preserve, to uplift the community.
All right, Nikki Clark, thank you very much, and we will see you on the 31st of January.
Fantastic. Thank you so much again for giving us this time, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
All right, take care of yourself.
And you okay, thank you.
You've been listening to Nikki Clark of the Ontario Black History Society and the Nikki Clark Show. And stay tuned. Molly and myself will be speaking with Dr. Rupert Lewis after we hear some great music from Hubert Winston McIntosh, a.k.a. Walde Semayat.
You are.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and I am on the line with Melinda Francis, with the technical assistance is coming from Lisa Watson in Minnesota, and joining us on the line is Rupert Lewis, the author of many books on Marcus Mosiah Garvey, and also a great book on Walter Rodney, I guess maybe the definitive book on Walter Rodney. And I'm looking at Rupert Lewis's anti-colonial champ, or Marcus Garvey, an anti-colonial champion. And Rupert Lewis, how are you doing today?
I am doing well, and all the best for 2016.
I have a question. Before we get started, I wanted to ask you a question. I remember, I'm trying to get some information. I remember the first time I met you was in Jamaica, and I came to a class you were teaching, and you had Manny Marable was teaching,
yes,
was lecturing that day. What year was that? You remember?
That would probably be 2005, 2006, maybe. And that's just off the top of my head, because you caught me unawares with that query. But somewhere
right.
In the first decade of the 21st century.
Oh, okay. I thought it was before that, way before that.
That's probably was the last time that Man in Marble visited, but he was in Jamaica in the 90s, as well as in the first decade of this century.
Right.
Okay. So it could have been earlier, you know.
All right. I'm going to let Melinda lead this discussion.
Okay. Yes. So, Professor Lewis, I was just wondering, last year, maybe wrap up what happened, sum up what happened in the Caribbean, in the region.
Well, I would want to start, Melinda, with the problems and challenges arising from the global economy and the contraction of the Chinese economy that has had a big impact on investments. If you recall that the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa, that group of countries was seen as the kind of on the cutting edge of global capitalism. We know what has happened to Russia. We know what has happened to Brazil in terms of their economic contraction. And this has also affected China and South Africa. So that a lot of developing countries had important contracts with China in particular for their natural resources, oil, and so on. So that but that cutback has had a very serious impact. In the case of Jamaica, the relations with China have not been adversely affected by the contraction in the Chinese economy. And a major infrastructural program in the region of $2 billion has been underway and is due to open in March of 2016. And that project is the building of a road from the southern end of the island to the northern end of the island, cutting through the mountains. And that project, which should have been done by a previous contractor from France, who claimed that they couldn't really complete it and that the government did not have the money to pay. In fact, the deal between Jamaica and China includes both the toll for the toll road, but as well as giving China a substantial parcel of land in the parish of St. Anne for investment purposes, particularly in tourism. That has caused some dispute and some debate in Jamaica about the extent to which our national interests are being protected in these new negotiations with China. So China remains the single largest investor in Jamaica over the period of 2014 to 2016. But to turn to the other area that has a mixed impact for the Caribbean, the decline in oil prices, that decline has had a tremendous benefit for Jamaica. People have been experiencing a reduction in their light bill and their electricity, and that has been significant. It's also significant in relationship to people buying petrol, as well as manufacturing and industry that use imported fuel. However, it has a downside for another Caribbean country, and the richest of the English-speaking Caribbean countries, which is Trinidad. Trinidad depends for 45% of its gross domestic product from oil, and 80% of its export revenue is from oil. So that in June 2014, 18 months ago, the price of oil was at $106 per barrel. And in the end of 2014, when they were preparing their 2015 budget, they estimated that the price of oil would be somewhere in the region of $70 to $80. As you are now aware, the price has fallen to $30, and there is some discussion that it may even go lower. So, bad news and consequences for Trinidad. They have had to have budget cutbacks, and they have had to take $1.5 billion from their savings in a stabilization fund in order to meet their recurrent expenditure. And then if one extrapolate this for this situation of low oil prices, you see the impact it has on countries like Nigeria, Angola, Mozambique, where the bulk of their export revenues would depend on oil exports. So that has had a significant, the change in oil prices, significant impact on people's living standards in the region. But the main program, that economic program that has been on the table in Jamaica since 2012, has been the International Monetary Fund program for Jamaica. And it is possible that other Caribbean countries may also have to go to the IMF, particularly that's the word. Trinidad is trying to avoid that by managing its assets, cutting back where it can, and so on. However, Jamaican IMF program has had, I would say, a mixed impact. The working class definitely has not benefited, in my view, from the IMF program, with caps on wages and with very little prospects, it would seem, for any significant increase in employment. However, sections of the Jamaican business class are very happy about the IMF agreement, particularly those who are in the foreign exchange market, tourism, and so on, because Jamaican products become cheaper with the devaluation. We've had a series of devaluations, and the Jamaican dollar is now going at about 120 Jamaican dollars for one U.S. dollar. So those people who are in manufacturing and depend for their manufacturing on imports from the U.S. or other dollar area countries have a rougher period. So that program is not being contested by any section of the Jamaican population at the moment. It's not being contested internally in the ruling party, the People's National Party. It's not being contested by the opposition, Jamaica Labour Party. It's not being contested by the trade unions. So that, in terms of how the Jamaican economy is, I 2016 will see a continuation of that, given the relative given the acceptance of large sections of the Jamaican population of the existing program. The other factor that has had a severe impact on Jamaican economy has been drought. And the drought has meant that Jamaican agriculture has had a very spotty year. And drought is when we have good action, it usually follows a period of rainfall. And that contributes to the people's diet, balanced diet, towards the increase of production that goes into the domestic market through the network of market systems that we have in the island. So the issue of climate change is definitely a practical question for many of for our populations. In one Caribbean island in Dominica last year, a hurricane did not really hit Dominica, but it passed close to Dominica, and the deluge of water and heavy rains, that deluge contributed to significant property loss and homelessness in Dominica. That was the only territory seriously affected by inclement weather, particularly the hurricanes. But let me turn. So that's on the economic side. I don't see much improvement in 2016, given the factors that I have indicated so far. Contractions in the global economy. For example, with our bauxite, one of the major investors in bauxite is reducing their labor force. And since 2008, with the world recession, the bauxite sector of the economy has suffered most. Now, we thought it would have picked up because indications are that reinvestors are coming back in for 2015, but we are now facing another period when there's likely to be contraction. The oil prices would have benefited the bauxite producers because they are among the heaviest users of fuel. And low prices should have assisted the return to production. But it seems as if the fall in demand for aluminum, that fall in demand will have a negative impact. On the political side, I think the main thing in the Caribbean in 2015, which will continue through to 2016, has been the normalization process underway between the United States and Cuba. That has been an important development. Of course, we all know that that normalization process doesn't depend exclusively on the American president, Don Obama, but depends on Congress because economic sanctions still are there on Cuba and can only be lifted by an act of Congress. And the Congress is not about to change that. Nevertheless, this has had some impact on the other Caribbean territories because most Caribbean islands are dependent on tourism, and they therefore see the opening up of Cuba as being a threat to their enterprise. That this has been the response. However, the Cubans have indicated that the other Caribbean territories shouldn't see it as a competitive in a competitive way, but looking at forms through which the opening up of Cuba can benefit other particular other territories pretty close to that market, and therefore initiatives from other Caribbean hoteliers and business people can play a role in terms of the opening up. Jamaica, the English-speaking Caribbean, has around 7 million American tourists. And with the opening up of Cuba, that's likely to go up to 10 million or so. So that's a huge political issue coupled with a huge economic issue. What this will mean for Cuba's radical political and economic, political and social structure is another question. What this will mean for the benefits that Cubans derive from health and education, that's another issue. But it also, the Cuban normalization process has also meant that Cubans who are having a hard time have been leaving in droves to get into the States. There are about 15,000 Cubans who last year were in Costa Rica, found their way to Costa Rica with a view to improving their life prospects, so that the migration challenges are throughout the Caribbean, from the north of Cuba through to the south in Guyana. That is a constant feature of Caribbean life. On the side of elections, there have been significant elections in the Caribbean, English-speaking Caribbean. In Trinidad, the People's Partnership government of Kamala Bisesa was replaced by the People's National Movement led by Rowley. And that was a significant electoral defeat. The People's Partnership government had become corrupt, and I think there was a swing towards the People's National Movement, founded by Eric Williams and led by a Tobagonian, Keith Rowley. There are also close electoral results in Guyana, where the opposition, again a coalition of opposition parties, replaced the People's Progressive Party, which itself had become very corrupt. And in St. Vincent, Ralph Gonzalez held on by a one-seat majority for his fourth electoral victory. The Jamaican elections should have taken place in the latter part of 2015, and we people here are awaiting the announcement of the date for 2016. So the region has been very much engaged in political elections. However, none of the campaigns so far really pose any serious alternative to the existing ways of governing, ways of facilitating participation, and so on. Finally, an election that has some significance for the English-speaking Caribbean, given the relationship between Venezuela and the region. The government in Venezuela lost their congressional majority to the opposition, and President Maduro nevertheless still holds the executive office, but is definitely in a much weaker position. But one should note that although the Petrocaribe arrangement, which allowed English-speaking Caribbean countries to purchase oil without having to make immediate payment on the basis of low interest rates, that has been, was a major asset to meeting heavy oil prices, and oil prices were over $100. But there are also other issues relating to Venezuela and the Caribbean, and the key other issue has to do with the huge claim that Venezuela has been making on Guyanese territory. And that is something that I think will occupy a lot of attention. Presently, Trinidad and Venezuela are discussing their respective maritime rights with respect to oil, offshore oil. So Venezuela has a problematic relationship with both Trinidad and Guyana, with claims that have been asserted primarily on Guyana.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio. I just wanted to say that we only have about 5 minutes, and there was a question I wanted to ask you, but I don't want to cut you off. Continue.
No, well, the main social issue that faces Jamaican population, I would say, would be the employment question and would be the violence. There are about 1,200 people homicides last year in Jamaica, largely from gun killings. And in a population of 2.7 million, that's very high. It puts us, we continue to be in the top 10 of countries with high homicide rates. But coupled with that, a definite development in the homicide situation is the emergence of this scamming of North Americans by Jamaicans with the participation of some Americans. The scamming has resulted in literally millions of dollars being stolen and entering into Jamaica, particularly the western end of the island, through people getting lists and contacts of people, of people in the United States, and telling them they have won a lottery or won something. And then they get this information, people begin paying. That whole scamming thing is about 300 million U.S., according to the estimates. So that's a huge, huge inflow into Jamaica, particularly in the western end of the island. And it's also linked to gun and drug smuggling. So this is a huge question in terms of Jamaican social order. But let me just conclude by referring to, we had the reparations movement in Jamaica has been very active in 2015. Under the chairmanship of my colleague, Professor Vereen Shepherd. And the most important moment concerned the confrontation between Prime Minister Cameron of the United Kingdom and the Jamaican political class in the parliament. And for the first time, the Jamaican political class in the People's National Party, the Jamaica Labour Party, took a single position that reparations was the claim for reparations was justifiable, and Cameron had to respond to that in the Jamaican Parliament. And I would say that his response angered people and provided another boost for the movement in relationship to our ability to draw, to educate more people as to why reparations claim was a proper claim. Cameron himself is a beneficiary of Jamaican slavery because his ancestors owned property and owned African slaves here. So that issue came to a head in Jamaica towards the latter part. And I would say the reparations movement for the first time had the support of the majority of the Jamaican people on this matter of reparations. And that work will continue, spearheaded by the Vice Chancellor, Professor Hilary Beckles, who has been very active on this matter in the Caribbean and in Jamaica, where he's now located as Vice Chancellor of the University of the West Indies.
Excuse me, Beckles is from Barbados, correct?
Yes, he's from Barbados.
Right, but he's based in UE now?
He has always been at UE. He was the principal of the campus in Barbados, and he's now the Vice Chancellor, and the Vice Chancellor is a person.
Okay, all right, okay.
All three campuses.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see much. I see those patterns that I've outlined continuing into 2016. I see social media playing a much more important role in regional and Jamaican politics as young people assert themselves and their interests in the coming year and have the capacity to take advantage of what social media offers in terms of being able to draw people into the agendas that they think are important.
All right, Rupert Lewis, we've run out of time, but is there anything that you would like to add? I'll give you an extra minute.
Well, I just wanted to add that Jamaica, the Caribbean, has been drawn into the ISIS struggle in that, according to the Americans, there are about 150 Caribbean nationals in Syria and Iraq. And therefore, that is going to be an issue in U.S. Caribbean relations. Most of these are from Trinidad, but there's a claim that there are also people from Jamaica and there are people from Suriname. So that's also another issue that's on the agenda in relationship to the United States relations with the Caribbean area. But I should end on a note that a lot of Jamaicans are looking forward to the Olympics in Brazil in the summer of 2016, and preparations are underway for that.
All right, we should definitely get you back way before then, because we need to talk about Mr. Boat and the rest of the team. Yes.
Yes,
So thank you very much.
Me. Yes, thank you very much. And
always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And we have been speaking with Rupert Lewis, and Diasporic Music continues with Noel Hanrahan after we listen to some music from Robert Nestor Marley and the Wailers.
Right out of Babylon, and we're grooving to our father's land. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man to see the unification of all Rasta man. As it's been said already, children of the Rasta man, we are the children of the I Am One. So, Africa, unite! Africa, unite! Unite for the benefit of our people, 'cause we're moving right out of Babylon. We're grooving to our father's land. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man to see the unification son of all Africans. Marcus Garvey said it, so let it be done. I know you know who you are under the sun. We are the children of the Rastaman. We are the children of the Ironman. So, Africa, unite. Africans, unite. Unite for the benefit of your people. Cause we're moving out of poverty. Moving to our fathers.
Gonna be a great class.
I know. Yet I'm still trying to figure out how I can exactly use these skills.
The Uhuru Movement.
The Uhuru Movement?
Yes, the Uhuru Movement. They offer great opportunities to utilize these type of skills in the most meaningful ways. I mean, writers, photography, graphic design, journalism, videography, video editing, even radio broadcasting.
Wow. Sounds great. I'm assuming you have to be pretty advanced.
Not at all. I mean, although experienced is welcome, it's not mandatory. You know, the Uhuru Movement, they will train you. Log on and sign up today at uhurunews.com, where your skills are wanted and needed. Whether reporting on local news, writing for an international newspaper, or hosting your own radio show, the Uhuru Movement is the place for you. Do you have a desire to work in sales, marketing, or administration? Do you have the talent for audio engineering? Log on and sign up today, uhurunews.com. Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
Thank you, brother. I will definitely follow up today.
And hopefully you'll become a member like I am.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. I'm with Melinda Francis and... joining us on the line is Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Noel Hanrahan, how are you doing?
Oh, thank you for having me on. I'm doing great.
I guess it's been a while since we've talked, but we in Canada, myself and Melinda, I guess we have the longest record of playing Mumia Abu-Jamal commentaries of anybody else in this particular country. So we're very concerned about Mumia, and we wanted to know his current legal situation and his legal health situation.
Well, you know, Mumia is stable. So 2015 has been a very disturbing year for his health. In March, on March 30th, he was rushed to the ICU at a local medical center near the prison because he was near death and renal failure. So Mumia has suffered immensely. So what happened with that was Mumia has had hepatitis C, and the manifestations of it that were apparent to him were these amazingly intense and open wounds and a skin condition that looks like eczema or psoriasis. That skin condition worsened to the point where they gave him topical steroids in March. Those topical steroids triggered a diabetic reaction. They noted it in his charts in the infirmary. He had lost 80 pounds. He was extraordinarily sick. He was running fevers. They noted that his blood sugar was at a very high level. If he was on the outside, he would have been rushed to a hospital then, but they didn't. They just wrote on his chart, monitor him. For the next 3 weeks, this was the beginning of March, they didn't monitor him, and he went into a diabetic shock, and then he was rushed to the hospital. So we knew that Mumia was ill, and we had begun to engage his medical and legal team, and we sent a person the morning of March 30th to his prison to actually get him to sign some medical records forms. And they called us and told us that he had been rushed to the hospital. So we all drove out to the hospital, and then we immediately began demanding that the prison do diagnostic testing. So he got a lot of diagnostic testing, really ruled out. He got 5 biopsies, ruled out almost every form of cancer, and it really narrowed it down to a manifestation of his hepatitis C. Then we had to demand that he get testing for what's called a viral load to see if the hepatitis C was active, and they refused to do that. Even when they sent him to this, we got them to send him to a tertiary care facility, a better hospital than the original one he went to, and even then they were refusing to test for hepatitis C. So we demanded it. We finally got the active confirmation that he has chronic and active hepatitis C, and then we have to go to court. So we're in court right now. We had a hearing in December trying to force the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections to give him what is a cure. There is a 12-week treatment, one pill a day, that has a 96 to 99% cure rate for hepatitis C, and the prison has refused to provide that treatment for the majority of inmates, most inmates in Pennsylvania. So we're in court with the preliminary injunction hearing that just concluded where we crushed them. We made an extremely strong case that Mumia should get this medically indicated treatment. That's where we are in terms of Mumia's health. Now, he's stable right now. He's still in the infirmary. He does not have open wounds. He's being monitored very closely in terms of his blood sugar levels and also his overall health. He himself says he feels more stable. He's able to not come out to visits in a wheelchair. But the chronic condition, like hepatitis C, is a progressive disease. What we learned in court, which is something they didn't give to Mumia, Mumia learned himself, only learned while they were on the stand, that he has a 63% chance of liver cirrhosis. So we learned that information knowing that this is a progressive disease, meaning that it's getting worse. It is already documented that it's attacking his organs, including his liver. So any time that goes by does more damage. So we're really, really pushing very hard to get the federal courts to issue an order that they will give him the cure, to give him the cure. It seems so... like they should have done that already, but we are working very, very, very hard on that. And he's calling, he's active, he's energetic. People can go to the website and hear his commentaries, but he knows he's not out of the woods. Like, he wrote me a note a couple days ago saying, you have to tell people that, look, I know I'm not back, and I know that I need to take care of my health, so you have to help me communicate that to people and tell people that, yeah, I'm really trying to focus on my health right now.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We are on the line with Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio, and let Melinda ask the next question.
Yeah, my question is, so you said that you're still trying. So what does that look like? What does that process look like? Is it another appeal? Like, what is
We had this extraordinary hearing on December 18th, 22nd, and 23rd. It was 3 days of a trial for a preliminary injunction hearing before a federal district judge in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And it's kind of compressed. Like, you don't get a discovery. It's hard to prove things. Our burden was very high. We had to prove that there was irreparable harm being done to Lumia and that they could and knew and should have known and do know that they should be providing the medically indicated care. So we went into that hearing knowing there was a high burden, and we, on every single level during that hearing, the testimony that was put forth proved our point that they know that they should be doing the hepatitis C treatment that the Liver Association and the AMA says is the standard of care, which is the new fast-acting antiviral drugs that just came on the market in 2013. And they know it, and that they are refusing to deliver that care. So we proved that through their own documents, getting them on the stand. And the hearing was shocking. Like, I do a lot of casework over the years. For 25 years, I've been involved in either suing the state, the FBI, or local police departments for a variety of reasons. And I've never been in court and seen, the first day was shockingly amazing where we pounded them into oblivion. The second day, they tried to put forth a document that they wanted held under seal. And this was their interim hepatitis C protocol. Well, I walked out of the courtroom at a break when they were handing it to the judge and filed a right to know request with the Pennsylvania Right to Know Office citing that document specifically. Well, it came back to court. They still tried to suppress it. The third day, at the end of the hearing, the judge said, well, we need to figure out the seal, that this document is going to be held under seal. And our lawyer said, no, actually, that's been resolved. And I was like, whoa, hey, what happened? And they said that halfway during the third day, the Laura Neal, the Department of Corrections lawyer, came over to our side and said, here's the document. We've been ordered by the Right to Know Office to give it to you. So this document is shocking in its callousness. So it proposes to provide no care for the vast majority of chronically ill and dying hepatitis C patients. Pennsylvania has 17,000 patients with hepatitis C. They have approximately over 1,000 that are seriously ill with chronic and active hepatitis C, and they are refusing to treat all but five. And the five people that they say they're treating are people who have this one specific complication from hepatitis C, which is thrombosis of the throat. So it's this incredible process where your throat blood vessels can explode and you can bleed out through your throat. Now, it happened to a friend of mine who's a Native American, former Native American prisoner. He survived, but most people don't survive. So that what they want to do is prevent the people who have this throat varices from bleeding out. And so they've treated five inmates, and they have to give them a throat endoscopy to determine whether they have this condition. If they don't have the condition, then they wait 3 years to give them another one. But those are the only five people they're treating in the entire system. Now, what that means is that every single other inmate for the last 22 months who has hepatitis C and has liver cirrhosis is dying. Mm-hmm. They're not treating anyone. So it was beyond what we could imagine that they would be pretending. Like, their whole position throughout the first 2 days of the trial were, people, we have a protocol. And then they tried to suppress the protocol. And then when they handed it to Brett, the guy said, the junior lawyer from the DOC said, we didn't want this out. We weren't going to give this to people because we're very worried about the liability it presents. Because there's a class action lawsuit for the 17,000 people who have tested positive for hepatitis C. So wow. There's like a huge liability for them. But we were able to keep that away. And then I'll tell you the next thing that happened. Now day three. So day two, we did great. Day one, we did fantastic. Day three, the judge is still on the fence. He's saying to their lead expert, Jay Cohen, Dr. Jay Cohen. Now, they wouldn't let us bring in that he was the head of medical care at Rikers, and they just lost their contract because of death. So we tried to bring that in, but the judge was like, no, I don't want to hear about his management of Rikers Island Penitentiary. I only want to hear about his being an expert in liver function. He's a hepatologist. So he was talking about this one test score. Mumia didn't qualify. That's the punchline. The punchline is their expert said Mumia didn't qualify because he didn't score high enough on the APRI score, APRI score. So their final witness comes to the stand, another doctor, another expert. He's the director of medical care for all of Pennsylvania prisons, Paul Noel. He gets up on the stand, and we hand him his affidavit. And we say, well, I want you to review this affidavit, and we're going to ask you some questions about it. He says, that's not my affidavit. And so the courtroom goes completely silent. You could hear a pin drop. Robert Boyle, one of our attorneys, says, well, isn't that your signature on the fourth page? And he says, it is my signature. I signed the fourth page, but the rest of it's not my affidavit. So Robert Boyle takes the document, goes back to the counsel table for the Department of Corrections and compares the documents because we got them from them. And it becomes clear that it's the same document that was proffered, was given up and given to the court by the Department of Corrections. So he goes back up to the witness and says, what part of this affidavit is not your affidavit? And Dr. Paul Noel, the head of Department of Corrections Medical Office for Pennsylvania, says, paragraph 21, I told the Department of Corrections in September, I told them in December, and I told them in the parking lot today outside of court that was not my testimony, and I didn't sign it. So now the Department of Corrections lawyer perks up and says, but I was talking to you in the car outside the courthouse, and you said that the numbers were correct, and we went over the numbers. The number in that paragraph were correct, the APRI score. And he says from the stand, the numbers in the paragraph are correct, but the conclusion is false and misleading, and I did not sign it. So now the judge is, like, really angry. So we caught the Department of Corrections submitting a false affidavit, and the punchline is they were trying to say that having a viral score of a certain amount of viral load had anything to do with disease progression. Well, it doesn't. And this doctor, of course, knew it didn't. But the paragraph 21, said Mumia did not deserve care because he had a low viral load, which is not the scientific evidence of what is disease progression, actually, in this case, for hepatitis C, HCV. And so that was just incredible. So we caught him in another lie. There was another paragraph that, of course, was altered and wrong. And so their own witness destroyed their own case, and it happened at the very end of the day. And so it's very, very clear that by their own standards, this doctor then went on to testify that they don't use the APRI score because it's too insensitive. It doesn't predict well enough whether someone's going to get cirrhosis. He pulled forth a document that we'd never seen before. He starts reading from it, and he says, we use the HALT-C score. And by the HALT-C score, Mumia Abu-Jamal has a 63% chance of having liver cirrhosis, which is the first time Mumia had heard that, right? Yeah. So that was distressing. So the level of then he goes on to explore and explain that who they don't treat and why they don't treat them and who they are treating and what the hepatitis C clinics mean, meaning that if you have chronic hepatitis C, you're put in the infirmary in isolation. You're put in isolation, and then you're going to die. Mm-hmm. And when we were in the ICU at an outside hospital with Mumia, who was there, but they wouldn't tell us he was there, but we could see his feet. We could see the phalanx of guards. We were at the nurse's station. They would not confirm he was there, but they were, intimating that he was there, and we could see him through the glass. we talked to the pastor or the chaplain who for this Schuylkill Medical Center, and he said, oh, it's so unusual to see people's families here. And so I look at Mumia's older brother, Keith, and Pam Africa, and we're looking at it like, well, what does that mean? He says, well, they don't usually let people's families here when people are in the ICU.
Hmm.
Yeah. And so we were devastated by that. We were like, people are dying here, and they're not able to, and they're chained to the bed. You're chained, like your right arm to one side of the bed and your left foot to the other side of the bed, and you're dying. So this is the realities of what we're documenting is just it's unspeakable. I mean, it's really, really, really hard. And I know I just went on for a really long time, but it's like this stuff is really hard. I mean, it's very hard for all of us because we're really seeing the inner workings of a system that is as callous as slavery, worse, as callous as slavery, not worse. It's all the same. It's the same. It's absolutely the same. It's the same. They have no regard for human life.
Well, Noel, we only have 5 minutes left, and I basically think you would like to let the listeners know and the people listening what they can do in order at this point to get Mumia out and to, you know, what is to be done? I guess that's the burning question.
You know, I think anything people do provides this level of catalytic energy. Like any activity that you can raise the consciousness of Mumia or other political prisoners is really important. Now, Mumia specifically, there's an Indiegogo. We just made our goal on the 13th. For our Indiegogo campaign, Abu Jamal versus Crestes, raising money for the lawsuit, getting Mumia's voice out, talking to people, getting postcards, visiting prison radio. Anything people do creates this level of consciousness and change. We're sending letters to the Department of Corrections, the doctors. We're very active and assertive in getting, we have an I Am Color of Change petition. There are lots of different Mumia groups that are doing stuff. If you Google it, you'll see it. But it does matter. Like, actions matter. You don't know what the tipping action is, and it really does matter. Like, everything people do does broaden the consciousness. And we're not going to win just in the courts. We have to have people hold the courts accountable. You can't win. They will not give us relief. They'll give us whatever they think we'll tolerate. And so we need public pressure.
Anything else, Melinda?
No. It's a lot more work to do, I guess.
You're recording Mumia's commentaries still every week. Today is the anniversary of the assassinations of John Huggins, Bunchy Carter in Los Angeles, and also the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, Joseph Okito, and Maurice Impolo. I would really like to get Mumia's views on those situations. I don't know if he's done anything on that yet.
You know what he did? But I know that last night. So I recorded him last night, and his piece was called "MLK, Enemy of the State." And
right.
How William O'Sullivan and Hoover tried to destroy or attempted to, do what they did based on the church committee thing. So he's like, if you're celebrating Martin Luther King Day, you know, really, you know, you're celebrating the state's attack on this man. So he did that, and I'll mention to him the other, Bunchy Carter and Patrice Lumumba.
The other thing is I really would like myself and Melinda to get an interview with Mumia. I know that's we've been talking about that for a long time, but whatever I can do, whatever we can do to facilitate that, if that's possible, we would really like to interview Mumia.
I will send you back the, this is how you go about contacting Mumia about interviews, and I'll give you the three different ways you can try and do it.
Yes, ma'am. All right. I guess thank you very much for your time, and we will continue to send our information out about Mumia and do continue doing what we've been doing, and this interview is being heard. We have listeners now, a lot of listeners in as far away as Russia now. Russia, with people in Africa and Japan. We have this internet radio is a beautiful thing.
Wow. Yeah, it's great. Well, it's really, thank you for doing it, because it matters. I mean, it just, the amplification of Mumia's voice is so important.
All right, so thank you very much.
All right, take very good care.
All right, and anything else, Melinda?
No, I think until next time.
All right, so this is Norman Otis Richmond, Melinda Francis. We are going to be paying tribute to Nicholas Caldwell of the Whispers and Natalie Cole. We have another hour left, and we will continue the music, so stay tuned, and we will be back in a few seconds.
We're moving right out of Babylon, and we're grooving to our father's land. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man to see the unification of all Rasta man. As it's been said already, we are the children of the Rasta man. We are the children of the I Am One. So, Africa, unite! Africa, unite! Yeah. Unite for the benefit of the people. Cause we're moving right out of Babylon, and we're grooving to our father's land. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man to see the unification of all Africans. Marcus Garvey said it, be done. I know you know who you are under the sun. We are the children of the Rasta man. We are the children of the I Am One. So, Africa, unite. Africans, unite. Africans unite, they say, Africa.